Hello and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan. I'm a senior editor at Bloomberg.
And I'm Valdana Hayrick, a cross-asset reporter at Bloomberg.
And this week on the show, well, the markets have gotten hit with a 1-2 punch. A hawkish pivot from the Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, and a new sort of alarming variant of the coronavirus that's spreading around the world. Will these two combine to form the Grinch who stole the Santa Claus rally? We'll get into it with a Goldman alum who is now the chief investment officer at Kestra Investment Management. But first, Valdana, I wanted to thank you for holding down the fort for the last couple weeks while I was out. I was actually, first my wife got COVID and then I got COVID. And as you know, I'm not usually on time with things. Like COVID, you know, the early adopters got it almost 2 years ago. And here I'm finally getting it now, you know. It's right on brand for me. Like I'm still listening to Taylor Swift songs, the scooter versions, you know, to give you an idea.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, don't say that. You're going to offend a lot of podcast listeners.
I'm trying to recalibrate the jokes to your generation. But anyway, Valdana, tell us about this week's guest. I just met her for the first time. I'm excited. What do we know about? What's your intel on this guest?
Well, first I want to say welcome back, and we really missed you on the podcast.
I don't believe that. In fact, I haven't even listened because I assumed you spent the whole time roasting me on the last two episodes. So I'm
a little bit. Maybe don't re-listen to them. But I did miss you. I'm glad to have you back, and I want to thank everybody who helped fill in over the last couple weeks. But then let's bring in our guest. Her name is Kara Murphy. She's the chief investment officer of Kestra Investment Management. Kara, I spoke with you recently. I had so much fun talking to you, and I want to thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. And you guys promised me it would be fun. So it was an easy yes.
It's supposed to be fun. It's a really high bar.
Well, Kara, tell us a little bit about Kestra. I don't know a lot about the firm. So just give us sort of the overview about Kestra and how you ended up there. It's only been a few months you've been there, right?
That's right. So we are a wealth management firm with a number of different channels. So there's Kestra Financial, which has advisors all throughout the country. Grove Point, we also work with Arden Trust Company, and then Blue Spring. So we have a number of different channels and ways in which we work with financial advisors. As you said, I joined a number of months ago to build out Kestra Investment Management. And so my remit is really to build out investment resources, research, commentary, strategies to be able to assist advisors in managing their clients' wealth. So it's been a wonderful opportunity for me to kind of have a blank sheet of paper and build something that we think is going to be really helpful and valuable to advisors.
And I want to get into some of your strategy and how you're thinking about things, but just to start things off with the big events that we had this week, because it was a really, really busy week. As Mike mentioned, we had these headwinds that really weren't here a couple of days ago. We have the new variant plus a Federal Reserve that potentially could be withdrawing stimulus at a much faster pace than we had previously thought. So how are you thinking about this, and how are some of these developments impacting your strategy?
Yeah, as you said, it's been a very interesting week. You know, you kind of come back from a holiday and hope it'll be a little quiet, but it never quite works out that way. But it's not too dissimilar to where we were over the summer. So just as the Delta variant was getting going, we were starting to understand that it was much more contagious, and we were starting to see rapid case increases in the U.S. And that happened just at a time when the Fed was gearing up to start withdrawing stimulus. So as those two things unfolded around the same time, Delta ended up becoming more of a headwind than maybe some had initially thought. And that actually got the Fed to hit the pause button a bit and pushed out expectations for tapering and for Fed rate hikes. Now roll forward a couple months more, and the kind of stakes on both sides have increased a little bit, where we have another kind of unknown variant. We know that the market hates unknowns. So in the absence of information, people often go to dark places, right? So the market is sometimes assuming the worst about this new variant, at the same time that we're seeing more evidence of inflationary pressures. And I think we should break down kind of what's driving some of these inflationary pressures, but clearly the stakes have gotten higher for the Fed. And so we've seen a big change in language from Powell, and the market's starting to pull forward expectations for tapering and Fed rate increases.
Well, Carrie, my colleague Cameron Kreis has a sort of a jokey line that he puts in columns, and that's that, you know, everyone got a master's in epidemiology from Google University
for sure.
This year.
Right.
You know, I know as a chief investment officer, I'm sure you've got that too. So there is this sort of echo of the frighteningness of the Delta variant with this Omicron variant. What have you learned about it? How are you thinking about it specifically? I mean, is it potentially a false alarm, do you think, that everyone's sort of freaking out about this?
This is me speaking as an investor and not an epidemiologist, but there is definitely a chance that this is a false alarm. And again, I don't mean to downplay like the very real human impact of this, but when we think about how businesses, individuals, economies have been able to react in previous periods, we've gotten better and better with every month that goes by in this COVID environment. So assuming that this new variant is not a wholly new kind of type of disease, we have better therapeutics, we have people being more careful in their behavior, we have, you know, a large portion of the population vaccinated. So we have a lot more tools today to be able to manage through this than we did before. And then put on top of that, we all know how to use our Zoom. We've all gotten used to working remotely. We know how to order things online. So I think the economy and people are in much better position to be able to handle a setback, even if it isn't a setback.
Yeah. I still mess up the Zoom from time to time, but I
know. I do too.
Yeah, we all do. And then, Kara, the other part of this obviously is the Fed. I know before we started taping the podcast, Mike and I had this conversation where I told him I had written this story saying that this is the most hawkish Jay Powell has been in about 3 years. I got some emails from Bloomberg users, terminal users saying, actually, you can't really use that word to describe him. So how much of what's happened this week, how big of a role does Powell play in the sell-off that we saw over the last couple of days? And do you think that the reaction was rational?
So I do think that the market had a bit of an overreaction, which is not uncommon, right? When you see a big pivot in a viewpoint with somebody like Powell, who is very influential, you can often see the market kind of overreact in the short term. And remember that we only just recently had renomination of Powell. So his sort of level of authority has been reinforced because of that nomination. So I think his word carries very heavy weight. He was also very clearly associated with the dovish camp within the Fed. And so to see him move a little bit more toward that hawkish end, I think is quite significant. But, you know, I might agree with some of those terminal users who reached out. We're like, I don't know that I'd call him a hawk. He's just a little bit more hawkish than he had been before.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I my guess is he reserves the right to be going back to a dove in the spring or the summer if
Right. I mean, all we need are a couple data points in the other direction, and he could very easily move back to the other side.
You know, Kara, one thing I know you keep an eye on is the credit markets and credit spreads. Reading some of the notes you sent over to us with some of your thoughts, and you know, pointing out that, you know, the credit markets haven't really sort of freaked out over these developments. I mean, spreads are widening out a little bit, but boy, historically, if you zoom out on the chart, you can't even notice it. To me, it's fascinating. I mean, you certainly, I'm sure, have clients who are actively engaged in credit markets or at least dipping their toes in it. You know, for people sort of just looking at the stock market, though, there's this tendency to, you know, for stock investors to always seek a second opinion from someone they think is smarter in the fixed income markets. And the temptation is to look at credit markets and say, well, they're not really freaking out. This is a false alarm. You know, and I think about it as like the participants in credit and fixed income tend to be a entirely professional investing class. Whereas in the stock market, you've got Reddit and Robinhood and everything else and not entirely driven by, you know, the CFAs of the world. I'm curious how you are looking at credit markets as sort of the signal for the stock market. You know, the Fed, while Powell's a little bit more hawkish now, I feel like, you know, the Fed really sort of changed the game with their credit facilities during the pandemic, actually being willing to go out and buy corporate credit. And I know they didn't really end up buying a whole ton, but sort of the symbolism of it, of the Fed sort of breaking that glass and breaking that seal, does that at all sort of break that signal from credit markets that we rely on, in your opinion?
Well, it's so interesting that you mentioned about like stock investors looking to the bond market for confirmation. And like, I often think of stock investors versus bond investors, almost like Gryffindor versus Slytherin. You know, there's this like healthy level of competition between the two. And there's always this like real fealty to wherever it is that you came from. I won't say whether like who's the Slytherin house, but there is like a fair amount of sort of like loyalty, saying like, if you're a stock investor, no, the stock market is the one that's giving like the real signals. But I think any investor is going to look for more than one single data point to confirm, right? Especially in very fast moving markets. You know, like I think back to the global financial crisis, I was then a stock analyst covering financial companies, and we would use the credit markets a lot because they were often picking up signals, particularly in like short-term funding markets, that the equity markets were missing. So there are times when there's one part of the market that's a little bit closer to the story. I think in this particular instance, like we really aren't, we're not like looking at a lot of stress in general in credit. And so I wouldn't say that like credit markets are necessarily closer to the locus of the issue. It's just yet another kind of signal to be able to put alongside these other ones. So in this case, you know, you're going to look at the full set of data that you can. And what that's telling us is that there's nobody there who's raising the red flag.
Mike, I feel like you'd be in Ravenclaw or Hufflepuff.
Those are Harry Potter references, right? I think I picked up on them.
Oh,
my God. Okay, so you'll probably watch Harry Potter in like 20 years the way you're trending.
I'll catch up with that eventually. Yeah.
Kara, I promise we'd talk about your strategy. Can you talk a little bit about what you're expecting for 2022? I think in one of your notes you had said it would be really healthy for the market to churn sideways for a bit, which struck me a little bit because that might sound a little bit disappointing to somebody who was expecting a rally into year end. And so how are you thinking about the next couple of weeks? What are you expecting? And then looking into 2022, what are you expecting there as well?
Yeah. So if we roll back briefly to like 2020, where we had this massive air pocket in the economy, corporate earnings took a really quick dip down. And then as the market started to recover, you had prices that were recovering way before earnings did, right? So all of the increase in stock prices that we had in 2020 was really driven by an increase in valuation. And when we roll forward to 2021, then we had a really big rebound in corporate earnings profits and some compression in valuation. And that's a healthy thing. And that's typically what we'll see coming out of a downturn. And so I would expect to see more of the same into 2022. We already have corporate profits that are at or near historic highs. We have really, really strong corporate earnings growth. We think corporate earnings growth will remain strong in 2022, but not as strong. But if we have a market that's just churning sideways for a little bit, it just gives time for those earnings to catch up with the prices that we have right now.
Yeah, I always think of it as a correction on the other axis, you know, not on the price axis, but the time axis. And I mean, you know, as far as valuations go, do you think that top has been set? Do you think?
Never say never, right? I've learned that it's very hard to call like specific turning points. So valuations typically are a very bad indicator for market turns, because we can stay expensive for a long time, we can stay cheap for a long time. But what they are good at doing is forecasting forward returns over like a medium term time period. Right now, valuations are high relative to historical measures. That doesn't mean that the market's going to turn down, but it does mean it should keep a lid on returns over the medium term.
And then another one of your notes said, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think it said that it's sort of a contrarian call that once inflation turns, we'll see a swift reversal. So I'm wondering if you can lay out the time frame around that and your thinking around that and how it potentially affects markets.
Yeah. And so this is, I don't know if you guys have had this experience, but like we had some new cabinets in our house and we ordered new poles, right? Like simple, like pretty like basic thing, but we ordered them about like 14 months ago.
Yeah.
And we've reordered them multiple times, right? So they're sitting on some ship, you know, off the port. So we ended up ordering three different sets, not knowing which one was going to arrive when. And in fact, we ended up getting two partial orders. So it was good, right? But someday that third order and the rest of the orders are going to arrive and we're going to have a bunch of poles that we don't really need. So think about that replicating all over the economy, where you have, and in fact, there was just an article the other day about store owners that were starting to order additional amounts of inventory just to be prepared and have stuff on their shelves. So once all of those ships get unloaded, once that inventory gets on trucks and it gets to stores, there are going to be certain types of goods where we end up having more inventory than what we had originally forecast. And that's the challenge in managing this inventory in a time when like demand and supply are changing so rapidly. So, you know, it's you asked about a specific timing, and I think it'll depend on the specific good that we're talking about. So for instance, like lumber was one of those commodities that started to shoot up fairly early in this cycle. And you started to see people who were reaching out and buying lumber ahead of time because they were worried that the price would keep going up. Well, sure enough, those prices are down like 60% or so from that peak. So that reversal came very, very quickly. So ones that went up more rapidly are likely to decline more rapidly. And it won't all happen at the same time. It'll be kind of sequenced out.
We had the exact same experience. You know, stuck in the house, my wife decided it's the perfect time to redecorate and, you know, ordered
naturally
new dining room chairs. We got a new front door. I mean, we never got the first thing you wanted.
Right. It's so frustrating.
It's such a nightmare. But Kara, I think I always picture some of our listeners sitting there sort of, you know, rolling their fingers on the desk saying, just tell me what to buy. Have this person tell me what to buy right now. So can you kind of break it down to us sort of what's attractive to you, both from, you know, sort of an allocation standpoint at this point in the cycle and also, you know, what you like in each bucket of allocation?
So like one word of warning that I would have is make sure that your overall portfolio allocations are aligned with your risk level and your strategic goals, right? So you know, when you think about the incredible growth in stocks that we've had over the last year or two, it's very likely that folks have portfolios that are out of whack, right? Where the equities have just become a disproportionately large portion of their overall portfolio. And so this is part of just being disciplined, right? And it doesn't matter where you are in the cycle. You should be just like looking at that portfolio and confirming, yes, you know, I am comfortable with this level of risk. Make sure you're honest with yourself, right? You don't want to get over your skis and have too much risk. Then the market turns down and then you're unhappy. So that's very important. And that just goes to like the good hygiene habits of being an investor. And then when I think about, you know, our expectation for returns going forward for both stocks and bonds are more muted than what we've seen over the last couple of years, no surprise. And as I said, that's part of, you know, earnings catching up with prices. Bond yields are incredibly low. There's only so much lower that they can go. So it indicates more moderate returns going forward. Within the stock market, we talked about valuation, and this reflects my bias generally as more of a value type investor. But we would have a preference for the types of companies that have, you know, strong growth characteristics, strong balance sheets, have the opportunity to start to return capital or increase their capital return to shareholders. And you can find stocks like that in pretty much any sector. So it's not necessarily a sector bet, but having a higher preference for quality in general.
I'm like 60% GameStop, 40% Shiba Inu. I got to make sure I rebalance.
That's a good mix. It's a really good mix. Actually, Shiba Inu was down earlier this week, even though it had some really high profile announcements around it. And
Oh my goodness.
But Kara, can you talk about where tech fits in with what you were just saying? Because it struck me a little bit by earlier this week, we had expected some of the bigger names to maybe hold up really well during the sell-off days that we saw. I remember looking at the NYSE FANG index, I think it was on Wednesday, and it was down something like 2.7%, which really struck me. So how are you thinking about where tech fits in with your strategy? And are you expecting some of the names to be outperformers going forward?
Yeah, now tech is a good example where you can find those really go-go stocks with super high aggressive valuations. And then you can also find some more mature companies who have like very solid earnings growth. So you can kind of find good examples of both types of stocks. And so, you know, in the sell-off that you were talking about, so typically when you get later in an economic cycle, the market tends to start to shift towards growth, right? Because overall growth is harder to come by, so we're going to pay more of a premium for those companies who actually can deliver repeatable growth. But then contrast that with where we are right now, which is that a lot of those valuations are quite stretched relative to historic levels. So I think when you have that risk-off environment, like we saw earlier this week, the market is punishing those that have the more lofty valuations and the less reliable earnings. So I think what the market is telling us is that in a risk-off environment, when we're worried, we're going to go back to that safety rather than looking for growth.
Kara, one bullet point in your notes I wanted to discuss a little bit. You say once inflation turns, we will see a swift reversal. Do you mean a reversal in this recent dip we've had, or a reversal in the
Oh, I mean a reversal in prices.
Oh, right.
So, and you know, I think that's worth drilling into a little bit more, right? There are sort of like two things going on with inflation. There's the supply chain disruptions that we talked about, right? And so the goods sitting off of ports and the multiple orders. And I think that's where you'll see the really big, swift reversal in price increases. And that's very concentrated in durable goods. And it's concentrated in a lot of types of prices that tend to be more volatile anyway. The other one that's more concerning, and this is a little bit more, I think, what Powell is looking at, is just like the you know, core, sticky, everyday type of inflation that's more tied to economic growth. And so, you know, we've had over the last couple of weeks, we've had some really strong indicators of almost a reacceleration of growth into fourth quarter. And the bigger concern is that very broad-based growth will find its way into those like sticky kind of core prices. So that's a part of the economy that moves more slowly. But certainly those durable goods, anything affected by the supply chain, I think will reverse quite swiftly.
So I keep wondering, well, how big of an effect can the Fed have on inflation until the supply chain stuff is sorted out? But I'm curious, so how you kind of look at that core stuff? Would you look at sort of a trimmed CPI measure or something like that? Or
that's another one where like you have to look at like a ton of different ways of slicing and dicing, because you're going to get very different answers, and you can't rely on, you know, your standard core PCE, because, you know, you look at it a slightly different way and you get very different numbers. So we've broken it down by, you know, core versus headline, trimmed, broken it down into like pandemic affected baskets versus non. And I think what it's seeing is that it's pretty easy to track that stuff that has been affected very directly by the supply chain. But it's hard to remove all of that from the core, from like the true core. But what we've seen is that in those specific indicators that we know are impacted by the supply chain, we have seen some of those start to peak and start to come down. So I mentioned lumber. Auto prices is another one where used car prices have started to retreat a little bit. And we've seen a number of other indicators like that that have started to sort of come on the other side.
Yeah, stuff that's not sitting on a ship somewhere.
Right.
To get in.
Tighten up your straitjackets. It's time for the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
Well, Valdana, speaking of core, obviously the core element of this podcast is the craziest things we saw in markets this week. And there's a lot of inflation in that area as well. The crazy things continue to keep arising. What are you got for us this week, Valdana?
Well, first I have to apologize to everybody because I've been calling it the weirdest thing which is it, crazy?
I'm in my bed sleeping during COVID and I'm getting texts, tell Valdana it's the craziest things, it's not the weirdest thing.
I should know better. I did get a submission from a listener. I have a submission from Alan Wagstaff in Minnesota, and he and I were actually exchanging messages via Twitter. He sent me a link to an eBay page that lists Spider-Man movie tickets, and at first I think the top one was for $70, and then as I scrolled through, some of them were going into the tens of thousands.
To see Spider-Man?
So it turns out...
I mean, I like Spider-Man and all, but...
Not for $25,000. So it turns out that advanced ticket sales for the movie had crashed AMC's website last weekend. And then AMC CEO Adam Aaron tweeted that the first 86,000 purchases of these special reserved tickets for a December 16th showing or some such, they were going to receive a Spider-Man NFT, but there was something like 100 unique NFTs. So it was a super complicated story. All these tickets, I believe, were getting bid up on eBay because of this and some other auction sites just because of the tweet and all of this that was happening.
Wow, that is fascinating.
So thank you, Alan, for sending that in.
Because there's NFTs, yeah. Sometimes I think that guy manages his company to optimize.
It's a strategy.
Segments. He manages to get in there. That's pretty good. I don't know. I thought I had a good one, but that's pretty good. How about you, Kara? What's your craziest and/or weirdest thing?
So we talked about inflation, but we haven't talked about housing, right? So the housing market has been going crazy, and I'm here in Austin where it's been especially crazy. But sure enough, outside of Boston, there was a house that had a serious house fire. So there was almost nothing left of the house. But sure enough, it went on Zillow for $399,000, as is. And I don't know, I've been tracking it to see if it's actually sold yet. But
a burned house.
That's a hot housing market.
Did they burn it to turn the house into an NFT? Maybe that's the
oh, baby. But put them on eBay and yeah, millionaires.
I sometimes think the press loves that story. This house that's a piece of junk sold, but really it's the lot, right? I mean,
you're right.
It's like it might have, that house was probably worth less with the structure on it than, you know.
Well, interestingly, so I looked and it's on Zillow and the Zestimate was pretty close to $399.
I'm assuming Zillow did not try to flip that one given their recent turmoils. But you know, I like that crazy thing because it allows us to talk about a more serious topic, which is this insane housing market. And I think anyone of a certain age who lived through the financial crisis to see house price gains like this is very worrisome. I mean, is there any concern for you of sort of a subsequent crash in housing prices? And you know, is the system hopefully better safeguarded this time than what happened last time?
Yeah. So, I mean, a key difference between today and 2007 is leverage. So if you look at mortgage lending standards, they're actually still fairly tight. And go back to 2007, mortgage lending standards had been loosening for years and lenders had becoming increasingly creative in offering financing to individuals. And then if you look just in general at consumer balance sheets, people have, you know, we have among the highest savings rates that we've ever had. Consumer debt levels are really low. Interest rates are really low. So when you do carry debt, the service payments are very low. So I think that the fundamental health of consumer balance sheets is much, much better today than it was in 2007.
Yeah, that's a great point. All right, I'll stop worrying about that. I've got a long list of things to worry about.
My job is done.
I'll scratch that one off. Again, mine's from the alternative asset class, the collectibles class. So this is an incredible, I encourage everyone to Google the story from the Washington Post. Really a well-reported story. It's about a letter from Catherine the Great, the Russian empress of the 18th century. She wrote a letter supporting mass immunization against smallpox. This is way back in the late 1780s. And for one thing, I'm fascinated at the fact that immunization goes that far back. But this story lays out the history of immunization, and it's even more fascinating. So prior to vaccination, they did what is called variolation, which instead of creating a vaccine, they would take a piece of the scab from the smallpox, or I hate to say the word pus, but take some pus from the smallpox wound and actually get that into your bloodstream. And that's how you would, you'd get the immunity to it. I gotta say,
okay, I'm never complaining about a shot again.
Right? I know. I'm not at all vaccine skeptical. I gotta say, I think I would have been a little variolation skeptical back in the day. But what's nuts is it's not even that far back. So the way this was discovered in the West was a slave in the early part of the 1700s who introduced it in the U.S. And he said in Africa, they were doing this for hundreds of years. It's fascinating.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, it's fascinating.
I encourage everyone to look up that story. It gives you a really great look back on that. And the reason she wrote this letter is because there was a lot of hesitancy and skepticism to this, which I can kind of sympathize with in this case. But anyway, to turn it into the craziest thing in Price is Right. So this letter she wrote, sold at auction, along with a painting of Catherine the Great from some famous artist. I don't know. But the letter is really the key thing. So time to play Price is Right. Karen Valdana, start with you, Valdana. What would you pay for this letter from Catherine the Great? Denominated in British pounds, by the way. You gotta account for the FX.
I'm notoriously bad at guessing these things. I'm going to overshoot. I'll go with 10 million.
Okay. I will keep my poker face. 10 million British pounds. All right.
Is that way too high?
I will say that Valdana is the type of customers that auction houses dream of, and you'll probably be getting some calls from sales reps at various.
I usually undershoot by a huge amount, so I'm trying really hard.
I might have tipped my hand a little bit there, but
you might.
Kara, forget I said that. What's your bid?
Well, I think a very important question is: are there NFTs that come with this?
I don't know. There's
I'm going to change my price.
You're free to burn the letter and sell it as an NFT, probably for what Valdana is talking about.
Okay, so I'm going to take the under then. Let's go with 5 million pounds.
You guys are big spenders. I thought it was a lot, 951,000 British pounds, which I thought
was
bargain. Yeah. Bargain. Valdana, we should have bought this.
Let's go for it.
Yeah, you should. You guys should go make a bid on that.
And then we can hang it up behind all of our Zoom calls.
There we go.
That would be a flex. That would be a flex in a Zoom call for sure.
That would be. Yeah. Oh my gosh, that'd be fun.
Yeah. I hang my wife's diploma because my diploma looks like, I don't know, something from a comic book. It's not a very distinguished looking diploma. I tell you a little bit about, maybe that colors a little bit about the university I went to, but my wife has a very distinguished looking diploma, so I hung hers up. And luckily no one has zoomed in enough to realize it's not mine, but.
It's not your name.
But with that said, I think that is all the time we have. Kara, really great to have you on. Really good conversation. I hope we can get you back someday.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kara.
Yeah, I love talking about burning houses. Let's do it again.
An NFT. Yeah. Thank you, Kara.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Valdana Hyrick is at Valdana Hyrick. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. And thank you to Charlie Pellet of Bloomberg Radio. What Goes Up is produced by Laura Carlson. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.